Political polarization is not just an ideological battle or a cultural battle. It's become also an existential battle, right? There's any number of issues that can't wait for people to work together. Climate change.
So if you watch TV or read the paper or check out the old Twitter, the growing political polarization in America is hard to ignore.
There is nobody that can help us more than Trump can.
Well, look, he's a coward. And he's always been a coward.
For China with Mexico.
Let him answer.
He doesn't want to let me answer because he knows I have the truth.
With you,
You get the final word in this.
Well, it's hard to get any word in with this clown. Excuse me, this.
Hey, let me just say to you.
No, Mr. President.
Polarization is the act of dividing something, especially something that contains different people or opinions, into two completely opposite groups. And polarization is one of the number one buzzwords of our time. We hear about how the political arena, as well as the rest of the society, is getting more and more polarized.
What worries me most and what keeps me up at night is, what if we do nothing? And when I look at a problem like climate change or the next pandemic, which unfortunately I think is probably coming sooner than most people realize, we need to do better. It's become an existential problem.
But is polarization a new thing, or is it a very, very old thing embedded in human nature as a part of a primitive survival instinct? How can polarization be a good thing, and when does it become a problem? And what can we do to decrease the polarization forces embedded in social media platforms? This episode of the Science and Cocktails podcast is about, as you probably guessed, social polarization in the society, today and before, and how social media is contributing to increasing polarization. And to enlighten us, we have...
My name is Chris Bale. I'm the director of the Polarization Lab at Duke University and a professor of sociology at the same place.
Who gave an amazing talk at Science and Cocktails in Copenhagen.
Attention, ladies and gentlemen. This is an announcement from planet X-31. Please take your seats. Teleportation will commence in 2 minutes.
Learn all about the mechanisms of polarization and what they actually do in a polarization lab on the other side of this jingle.
Get on your spaceship.
Interesting.
Machine is working.
Increase the frequency of lucid dreams in our laboratories.
Over time, the variation within a group becomes variation between groups.
It has to do with particles or objects and how they move.
Am I true? Am I awake?
We think that there is a kind of God against it.
What are the processes?
It's a piece of stuff.
We are moving in space-time. All of us go like 1 second per second, flowing up in the fourth dimension.
So, how did you get interested in polarization?
You know, it's sort of an autobiographical tale. You know, I grew up in a country, the French Congo, which was, at the time, deeply enmeshed in civil war. And, you know, I would have never thought that my country, the United States, or even many European democracies, would be so close to the point where, you know, people are willing to commit violence in the name of democracy. A recent report from the U.S. puts that number as high as 1 in 5 people is willing to resort to violence to support their political beliefs or causes. And, you know, at a very young age, I saw the consequences of that. And meanwhile, I grew up alongside technology, alongside social media. And I think anybody who experienced the world before social media remembers that it wasn't always this way. And so I think that, deep personal experience is the main reason I got into this.
So Chris Bale grew up in Congo while there was a civil war going on. And war is really taking polarization into extreme, where the people in power often use polarization as a way to justify going into war.
What would happen if there was a full-scale nuclear war between Russia and the United States?
Our visual analysis reveals how Israel and Hamas are fighting this war right now, and why this conflict is unlike anything we've seen before.
The war in Ukraine continues to gradually slip off the international radar as the global audience, media, and governments are turning their attention to the Middle East. But the Russian aggression on Ukraine is far from over, as Putin has ordered his troops back onto the offensive to recapture the strategic momentum on the battlefield. Meanwhile, Ukraine is trying to respond with long-range strikes and launching an offensive of its own on the left bank of the Dnieper.
Social media can be an effective tool in increasing the polarization in order to get public support for a political project like war. But polarization was here long before social media.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And, one of the things I'm really quick to point out is that political polarization in the US and Europe and many other countries existed long before social media. Too many people want a simple answer to this question, right? They think that if we could just shut down social media, that polarization would go away. Or, if we could just, walk into, let's say, Facebook or Instagram and flip a magic switch and it would sort of turn down the polarization. And much as I would like that to be true, our research suggests that it's not. It's just so many different, there's a lot of blame to go around. There's a lot of blame that should be pointed at social media companies, but there's also social media users themselves. And, it's really changed the way we interact with each other, and we have to become more reflective, my colleagues and I think, about how our own behavior bubbles up into these aggregate patterns that are really disturbing so many of us.
Okay, so polarization didn't come with social media. It's a part of human people.
I think so. In the U.S., people used to worry there was too little political polarization. In the 1950s, the American Political Science Association issued a press release warning that people weren't politically active enough. Right, they wanted people to be more passionate about the issues. But somewhere around 2012, the American public reached a point where anger towards the other party outpaced appreciation or love for your own party. And that's something social scientists like me often call affective polarization. So it's, polarization about the other people, no matter what they believe. You just don't like the other people. And that's the kind of polarization that we think is particularly toxic and can corrode the public sphere, right? It may make reasonable conversation impossible if we, can't even agree that the other side is sort of human.
So a little bit of polarization is actually a good thing because it makes us engage in the political debates and discussions about how to solve important problems in the society. But the problem with polarization appears when the hate towards the other group is stronger than the love for your own group or your own belief. And you become consumed by this hate, and it becomes more important to you than to actually contribute to solving the real problems. And this all-consuming hatred towards the groups that you disagree with seems to be growing all over the world.
And this trend has been getting worse since 2012. And many people will say, well, social media really took off around 2012, right? Like, this is the kind of heyday of Facebook, when it was going to connect the world and Twitter was going to serve the public conversation. Remember that? CC Elon Musk. And if you're wondering if this is just a uniquely American problem, it's not. See that in many countries, Switzerland, France, yes, Denmark, Canada, and New Zealand, are all experiencing an increase in affective polarization. There are some exceptions, but overall, this trend seems to be going on in many different places.
So yeah, going back to social media, so even though polarization has been there before social media, does it increase the polarization in our society?
It's such a hard question to answer because there's so many different kinds of social media. There's so many different, you know, social media takes on so many different roles in so many different people's lives. So I wouldn't offer a simple answer, but I would say that social media interacts with some of our human tendencies in ways that are probably pretty negative. So for example, you know, one of the oldest axioms of social science is that we learn about ourselves through observing the reactions of others, right? So we used to call this the looking glass self. And the idea is that, you know, as humans, like, we have this thing called a social sense. We're able to perceive our social environment in a way that, you know, most other creatures can't. And even though we think we're very good at it, and from a very young age, we learn to read the reactions of others and adapt our identities accordingly, we're very often quite wrong about what other people think about us. And this is some of the brilliance of social psychology and psychology, which has revealed through many seminal studies how this happens. With regard to polarization, it creates something we call false polarization, which is simply the fact that we all tend to exaggerate the extremity of beliefs of people we don't agree with and underestimate the extremity of our own beliefs. And the problem with that is it makes everyone feel more polarized than they really are. So turning back to your question, you know, what does social media do to false polarization? I think that social media sets false polarization into hyperdrive because it rewards a small group of status-seeking extremists who make a lot of noise and really ruin the party for the rest of us.
We'll get back to how social media set polarization into hyperdrive because of the small group of status-seeking extremes. But first we'll hear how Chris Bale got the inspiration to start the polarization lab.
So around 2016, I was up late at night, and I was watching the election results roll in from the 2016 presidential election. Everyone in my left-leaning college professor Twitter feed was already doing a proverbial victory lap about the apparent success of Hillary Clinton. It seemed inevitable. The pollsters had it at 99%. All of us just thought it was a done deal, right? And of course, the morning after, there was a lot of, you know, stock taking, a lot of blame going around. And many of us, myself included, thought, wow, I am really in a filter bubble. I'm stuck in a system that reinforces my pre-existing beliefs. I'm only connected to people who already agree with me. And surely I just would have understood that large numbers of Americans really respected and were excited about this guy, Donald Trump. And, you know, had I only popped my filter bubble, I might have seen this. Similar things may have happened around Brexit, right? All of us thought that wasn't going to happen. Whoops, you know. And one could argue, well, this is what people do, right? We surround ourselves with like-minded others. It's a human tendency. It's axiomatic in the social sciences that we tend to surround ourselves with people who already agree with us. But the concern with the idea of filter bubbles is that this is being algorithmically reinforced. That is, that Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, whatever platform you use, has learned our preferences and gives us more of the same. So with the hubris of a young academic, I set out with some colleagues at Duke University, where I'm a professor, and founded the Polarization Lab. And our idea was pretty simple. We're going to pop this filter bubble. And if we could only pop the filter bubble, we might be able to take off our partisan identities for a brief moment and empathize with each other and humanize each other. And if you know social psychology, you know that there's many studies going back half a century which suggest that intergroup prejudices can be powerfully reproduced if we simply experience each other, if we humanize each other, if we're able to have real life experiences that contradict the prejudices that tend to grow in the absence of group contact.
So what do you do in a polarization lab?
Yeah, you know, I think so many of us are concerned that, you know, we're more divided than ever. We have existential threats in the form of climate change. COVID was a potent reminder that when we can't agree to solve shared problems, we get into trouble. And so I founded the Polarization Lab to try to look at the relationship between social media and political polarization, and also to try to develop new technology to help reverse the course.
So what are those new technologies that you've developed?
Sure. You know, we use all sorts of stuff. Currently, we're doing a lot of work with generative AI to try to teach these so-called large language models to do conflict mediation. We've also built bots that go onto social media platforms to try to reward consensus and boost people who say, you know, sort of non-polarizing things. We do a lot of massive online experiments, and we even just do old-fashioned interviews like you and I are doing right now.
The so-called echo chambers on social media, where we only see and read things that resembles our own beliefs, might just be the consequence of the fact that we associate with people we share opinions with, which we would do with or without social media. So it's not an easy thing to study. So one of the studies Chris and his crew made at the Polarization Lab was that they offered a bunch of American citizens that were either Republicans or Democrats an amount of money for following a robot which would expose them to about 25 messages a day.
We didn't tell them what the messages were going to be. In fact, when the experiment began, we just showed them beautiful vistas of the Swiss Alps and, you know, lots of cats and really nice stuff, right? And gradually turned up the dial of out-partisan content. So if you were a Democrat in our experiment, you gradually began to see more and more tweets or messages from Republicans. Now, these were elected officials, like a Donald Trump, but also journalists, also advocacy organizations. And conversely, if you were a Republican, you not only saw Democratic elected officials, like Hillary Clinton, but you also saw advocacy groups, you know, advocating for birth control access, or CNN. And for one very long month, people experienced their filth bubble being popped. And at the end of the month, we surveyed people. We asked them the same exact questions that we asked them at the beginning of the month. And we measured all sorts of stuff. We measured what they think of about the other side. We measured their attitudes on many, many different issues. And we thought this would tell us what happens when you pop the echo chamber.
You can listen to Chris Bagel's whole talk on the Science and Cocktails YouTube channel to hear the details about how they made the study. But the concept is that Republicans were getting Democratic stuff and the other way around in order to pop the filter bubble. But what they found was the opposite.
So the Democrats did not move towards the middle, and the Republicans did not move towards the middle. Instead, the Democrats moved slightly to the left, and the Republicans moved more to the right than they had in 10 years of public opinion polling through one simple month of exposure to journalists, elected officials, and other high-profile public opinion leaders who were Democrats. I think that we've been using the wrong analogy. It's not an echo chamber. It's not a competition of ideas. It's a competition of identities. And we're exposed to partisan attacks, to attacks upon our group's identity. It doesn't provoke introspection and reappraisal. It forces us to choose sides. It gives us the need to elaborate our identity, and it leads to more polarization.
So social media is not a competition of ideas, but a competition of identities, which is relating to the way we learn about ourselves from we get born. We understand ourselves by experiencing how other reacts to us, and this is how we develop through our whole life. And this mechanism is what makes us so addicted to social media, where we can constantly search for other people's reaction to us. And what they found in their further studies was that a minority of people with too much time is trolling the social media out in extremity. But also people in general are showing their more extreme sides on social media.
So here's the nature of the problem. The reality of social media is you've got a ton of moderate people who have important, possibly productive things to say about the issues we've been talking about tonight, climate change, race and ethnicity and policing and immigration. And yet, what we see and what we perceive is very different, right? We see a preponderance of extreme people on both sides. Now, this is no doubt driven by a choice, somewhat arbitrary choice, I would argue, by social media companies some 15 years ago.
So do you think the tech giants, do they have a responsibility to avoid that their platforms increase the polarization?
Yeah, I think they do. You know, I think they have a huge responsibility. You know, like there's a number of ways that we could think about this. You know, a common story is that, you know, social media companies have polarized us for profit. And I think there's some truth to that, whether it was wholly intentional or not, I think is an open question. But the question remains, you know, should we expect these platforms, which were created for really silly sophomoric reasons, to serve as democracy's public square? You know, we all know that Facebook evolved from a platform that allowed people to rate each other's physical attractiveness. But a lot of people don't know that Instagram started out as a tool to organize alcohol-based gatherings, right? Twitter started out as a way for a small group of people to text their friends, right? I'm not even going to touch TikTok and YouTube, but let's just say they weren't designed to do what, you know, the great minds of democracy wanted us to, right? And so I don't think we should be surprised as consumers when social media polarizes us, when social media does not optimize for the collective good. Now, that doesn't mean it can't. It just means the current corporations, you know, aren't designed. It's not in their DNA to do it, even if they like to say that they're serving the public conversation and connecting us and all these things.
Do you think, like, now AI is starting to come, and so do you think that's going to have an effect also on the polarization in society?
I do. I'm concerned. You know, this new generation of AI tools, you know, collectively referred to generative AI, are really passing the so-called Turing test really well, right? They are able to impersonate humans. Study after study shows this. And, you know, it's pretty trivial to learn enough software programming to create a bot that can tweet this or tweet or spread a message created by an AI. What's scarier now is that I think you could deploy larger groups of bots with more sophisticated interactive capabilities. And, you know, people like me won't even be able to study their effect because we won't even be able to find them. You know, there are efforts afoot to try to create digital watermarks that would like create a sort of AI accent that would allow people with access to a certain set of tools to identify AI. But right now, that's not being implemented in a way that makes me confident that we can disrupt large-scale misinformation campaigns. So super concerning. Absolutely. Yeah.
So what do we need to do to stop this from escalating even more?
I think there's actually a lot of good news here. And I feel a little crazy saying that. You know, like, I mean, this is a dark topic, right? I think a lot of people are like, truth is gone, and, you know, we can't talk to each other anymore. And I don't want to minimize those negatives. But I do want to point out a few things. The first is that if we examine the history of social media, just about every 2 years, a new social media platform comes along. So, you know, I'm old enough, but probably some of your listeners aren't, to remember, say, MySpace and Friendster, and then Facebook, and then Facebook buys Instagram, and then TikTok comes along, right? And who knows where we're headed next? But it suggests there's a kind of churn, right? Most people aren't very satisfied with social media. They recognize its limitations, and they want it to be more useful. Surveys of the public indicate they also want it to be more positive. So, you know, I don't want to be all like Pollyannish about this and say that, you know, all we need to do is create a positive social media. I think that's a little naive, right? But there are ways, both from the top down at the bottom up, that we could address this problem. So my biggest recommendation for social media companies is to rethink the way that they deliver information to us. So a lot of your listeners probably know that the way that most people get information in their news feed is whether that content has been engaged with by other people, right? So if a bunch of my friends got angry about something that President Trump is saying on social media, right, then I'm going to see President Trump's tweet, and I'm going to see all my, more likely, I'm going to see all my angry friends yelling at President Trump before I even get to President Trump's tweet, if I read it at all, right? And so this sort of incentivizes people to say things that are engaging, regardless of whether they're constructive, right? But it doesn't have to be that way. You could imagine a system that actually optimizes for content that lots of different type of people like. This is something I've called a bridging algorithm. So the idea here is that an algorithm could actually boost the content that, say, both Republicans and Democrats like, or it doesn't even have to be political, right? It could be across racial and ethnic categories. It could be across gender. It could be across age. It could be international, right? And the idea is that we could boost the content that lots of people find useful, engaging, productive, right? All the things that would make us keep coming back to social media. And you can kind of imagine it, you know, this way. Right now, we've got a sort of addiction to seeing, you know, watching the slow train wreck on social media. But we could also, and we know one of our human biases is sort of fear of missing out, right? What is everybody else seeing that I have not yet seen yet? And could you show me more of that, please? And I think that's where there's a real business opportunity for a new social media platform, or maybe, maybe, just maybe one of the current platforms to adopt this type of technology. So that's one example of what gives me hope.
But what about regulation? Do you think there should be some regulation on it? From the political side?
Yeah, I do. I think the only hope of regulation is coming from Brussels right now. You know, the US is gridlocked with polarization, but the so-called Digital Services Act, I think, is a really good step forward for regulation. You know, specifically that it will create more transparency. One of the most frustrating things for experts in this field is that we're often unable to really discern the effects of the things that, you know, so many of us are speculating about, you know, things like echo chambers, things like misinformation campaigns, things like algorithms. We have a lot of popular narratives about what these things are doing, but we have very little high quality science. And it's difficult to make, you know, good policy decisions without good evidence. So one of the things I'm most excited about in the regulatory space is that these new policies could give academics like me more access to data within large companies that could really help us understand the effects of some of the choices that we think are happening. And, you know, one thing that stands out to me so far is that a lot of what we think is going on is, it might be wrong. And we're sort of barking up the wrong branch. And if we say, you know, spend a lot of time regulating echo chambers, for example, well, there's some research that says that might not be a great idea. So, you know, like, let's try to figure out what's going on first before we either accept the untested speculation of the software engineers who tend to design these things, who really, I think it's fair to say, know very little about human behavior, or politicians who are so old that they can't tell TikTok from Facebook, right? So we need some real evidence from the increasingly large group of people who study this.
Okay, but aren't we running against time? I mean, these things are developing so fast, and to find the right data, it also takes time to study it in the right way. And
yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, if I'm going to, you know, share some of the blame here, I think academics are too slow to provide solutions. You know, we're often interested in science for science's sake instead of, you know, Pasteur's quadrant, you know, which is this idea that there's a type of science which is both high scientific value and high public impact. And, you know, we can work in tandem with social media companies, entrepreneurs, and others to embed experiments in the rollout of new features and really do science in a more real-time way. I think that's essential. And to your broader point, you know, like, I think you're right. If the house is on fire, you don't just sit inside and watch it burn, right? And I think there is a community of academics who won't believe anything until there's 10 randomized control trials, right? And if we wait for those, right, we might be waiting for 100 years. So we have to find some middle ground.
So what are your hopes for the future?
Well, one thing I'm really excited about, earlier I was mentioning about concerns I and many other people have about generative AI, these tools that can impersonate humans, and AI in general, right? I think a lot of people are scared. But, you know, we have some new research that suggests it could also be useful in mediating conflict, as I was saying earlier. So you know, we did a large study where we had people arguing about gun control in an online setting like social media. And half of them, we served them recommendations from GPT-3 about how to phrase or rephrase their messages in a way that would make them more resonant with the other side. So we didn't force AI on anybody. We didn't say, like, we're changing your message, you know, or you should change your message. We just said, hey, here's a different way of saying what you're trying to say that might work a little better. When people used it, which they did quite a bit, we were super excited to see that the people they were talking to found the conversation to be less stressful, more enjoyable. They rated the other person as having higher quality argumentation and reason, right? It shows that, you know, for everything that AI can do to impersonate us and nudge us in the wrong direction, it may also help us sort of nudge ourselves in the right direction.
That's an interesting perspective.
I'm an optimist in the end.
I guess you have to be.
Yeah, in this line of research you do.
On that note, thank you for listening to the Science and Cocktails podcast. I recommend that you go to the Science and Cocktails YouTube channel to listen to Chris Bale's whole talk, where he goes much more into some of the very interesting studies and research projects they did at the Polarization Lab. This podcast is supported by the Novo Nordisk Foundation and produced by me, Sophie Hjort, for the Science and Cocktails organization. Music and jingle by Hjelte Bisted Hjort.